My name is Jeff Sutton. I'm a judge on the Sixth Circuit, and I'm really honored to start our first showcase panel. It's labeled Social Activism and Corporate Leadership. I'll take us back about 107 years, 1914. Then Louis Brandeis wrote a book called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It. This book became the blueprint for the future Wilson administration's antitrust regulatory efforts, probably earned Brandeis a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. And if there'd been a Federalist Society in 1914, we would have had a showcase panel on the book. I can almost assure you, I suspect Brandeis would have shown up. There would have been a few people disagreeing with him, but we would have allowed a fair debate. Barring from Brandeis, today's panel could be entitled Other People's Money and Power and How Corporations Use It. This being DC, there's an acronym for everything. One you're going to hear today is ESG, Investing in Corporate Leadership. The E is for environmental, the S is for social, the G is for governance. And the question is whether ESG investing in corporate leadership is a sound development. On the one hand, one could argue that it helps to leverage power and money to valuable ends. Nothing wrong with corporations having values, see Hobby Lobby. On the other hand, you might wonder if ESG investing is a creative takeover of government functions. So the stakes are quite high, and it's remarkable that we continue to debate how exactly corporations ought to work and be governed in this country. I feel really fortunate to have a front row seat to our debate and presentations. We've got four terrific speakers. In conventional format, they'll each speak for roughly 12 minutes or so. We'll have a little discussion among ourselves, and then we'll open it to the audience. In the order in which they're going to speak, we have Margaret Blair from Vanderbilt's Law School, who once was with the Brookings Institution. Following her will be Jonathan Macy from Yale Law School, author of Macy on Corporations Law. Then we'll have Luigi Zingales from the Booth School of Business at Chicago. By the way, the producer of a podcast called Capital Isn't, which is really terrific, has an episode on this exact topic. And last but hardly least will be Julia Mahoney from the University of Virginia Law School, who has a piece co-authored by her husband in Columbia Business Law Review, actually on this exact topic. So, Margaret, if you could get us started, that would be terrific.
So, good morning, and thank you, Dean, for that for the introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having me here today to talk about this. I think I'm not certain. Haven't followed the Federalist Society really closely, but it may be a bit unusual to start with a discussion of corporations instead of with various aspects of government. But corporations have become, and have been in some ways for a long time, incredibly important institutions in our society. They're part of civil society, but they are bigger and powerful than governments in many, with respect to many kinds of activities, and so they're really an important part of the landscape of what you need to be thinking about when you're thinking about government and civil society. So, I'm going to begin today by building on some ideas that our colleague on the panel here, Professor Macy, has written about and developed. And that is that there are a number of myths that have emerged and become important and become dominant stories in corporate law. Professor Macy identifies four such myths in his recent paper that he's written on this subject. And I'm only going to talk about two of them, which I think are most relevant to the topic for today. The first is that corporations are owned by their shareholders. This myth is derived from the belief that the shares of stock in a corporation represent ownership interests. And I put ownership in quotes, okay? So this is Professor Macy's argument. I agree with him, but I think for different reasons, and I'll say some more about that, okay? The second myth is that corporate officers and directors are legally required to carry out their duties in a manner that they believe will maximize the value of the shares of the corporation. He calls this the shareholder value myth. And so he uses that phrase. That phrase is the title of a book by a co-author of mine that I've written with a number of years ago, who died 4 years ago now. 2018, so yeah, 3.5 years ago, and who is a mutual friend of Jonathan Macy. He acknowledges her in his paper where he uses this phrase, he acknowledges the book. Professor Macy argues that these myths serve the social function, and I'm using air quotes here for a reason I'll come back to, the social function of, quote, legitimizing the current practice of giving corporations the same right as actual flesh and blood people. Now, the reason for the air quotes is that I don't agree that this is a social function. I think it's more of an anti-social function. But I think he meant it more, I think he meant the term social a little bit differently from what I mean when I talk about it being an anti-social function. So I want to make the point here today that these myths also serve another function, which is to try to legitimize actions and choices of corporate executives that cause their corporations to externalize as much as possible of the costs associated with their businesses and their business activity while trying to capture as much as possible of the benefits. For these reasons, I do not believe these myths are benign, nor are the function that they serve properly thought of as a social function in the sense of a socially beneficial function. Instead, they represent a major problem with capitalism in its current manifestation. A corporation is a legal structure, okay? It was organized for to facilitate the organization and deploying of property, contracts, and certain social arrangements in order to carry out a business activity. If the business activity is a needed business activity, we sometimes encourage corporations to do that, as we did early in the life of this country when we encouraged private individuals to build bridges. And our previous speaker this morning talked about how one of the important functions of government is to create roads and bridges. Well, actually, that was done privately. It was done by private sector organizations, but they were given special tools to use to do that in the form of making corporate law available to them. Actually, there was no separate law called corporate law. They were issued specific charters in order to be able to build a bridge or a road or whatever that was needed by society. So it's a legal structure. It's not a person. Okay, it's a rights-bearing institution. Okay, in the sense that it was created to make possible and that a separate entity that could own the property, enter into contracts, and that entity would be distinct from the individual persons behind the corporation, in the same way that a trust is a legal entity separate from the grantor, the beneficiary, or the trustee, and can exist in perpetuity, or a corporation can exist in perpetuity. It is certainly not a person and should not be granted constitutional rights in its own name or any rights beyond those necessary to carry out these functions. Recent Supreme Court decisions that seemingly grant to or protect a constitutional right in the name of a corporation are troubling to me, because I think it's important that the court act, that the court actually did not rely on the argument that corporations are persons. That's not what the court said in either Citizens United or Hobby Lobby. Instead, the court made an argument that corporations are associations of persons, and that it was necessary, in their view, that the corporation have the right in order to protect the rights of the persons behind the corporation. Okay, this is a derivative argument. It's not a direct argument, as Professor Elizabeth Pullman and I have argued in some works that we have done. I think it's a problematic way to protect the rights of the actual flesh and blood persons behind corporations. Okay, but at least we should recognize this is what the Supreme Court did in those decisions. It didn't ever argue that corporations are persons, therefore they get rights. Okay. Are corporations themselves the property of their shareholders? I agree with Professor Macy that no, they are not. Corporations are devices for holding property, but are not themselves property. Shareholders are one class of investor in the business. They have certain rights and obligations. Some are delineated in their issuing documents. Some are default rules that are in the statutes. Okay, these provisions make it clear that the corporation is different from the individuals who own its shares. Okay. One of the most important factors that makes it clear that shareholders are not owners is that they have limited liability, meaning that shareholders cannot be held personally liable for debts incurred by the corporation, whether those debts were incurred contractually or as a result of a tort claim that was, or a settlement of some sort, or some sort of regulatory action by the government. The effect of limited liability for shareholders, especially when combined with a share value maximization norm, is that corporations often pursue a goal of maximizing value for shareholders and will do so by pursuing risky activities that have very high upside potential for the shareholders, okay, without taking into full account the downside risks which often get imposed on other parties. Such activities are especially attractive from a shareholder perspective if they can externalize downside costs to parties outside the corporation. Okay, so this is clearly a situation in which maximizing value for shareholders is not the same as maximizing the total social value being created by the corporation. In recent years, we've seen automobile companies pawn off their underfunded pension funds in a federal bailout. Pensioner claims were slashed as part of that. We've seen federal government bail out financial firms when the bets that they made on credit default swaps failed. We routinely see natural resource extraction companies dump their wastes into local rivers. That's done less in the United States now, but it's done a lot in developing countries. Huge oil companies that cut their maintenance costs on their offshore oil drilling platforms, and the result is massive oil spills. And just a few weeks ago, actually, there was news about this morning, so I'm not certain I'm 100% up to date here. Johnson & Johnson announced that it had formed a subsidiary that would take all of the talcum powder business, along with all of its potential liabilities, which we now know are going to be fairly substantial, these are liabilities associated with the argument that they had that the talcum powder caused harm to because it had traces of asbestos in it. Of course, Johnson & Johnson would underfund this subsidiary and then immediately cause it to file for bankruptcy protection. Okay, this is called a I think, Texas two-step maneuver, which is it protects the parent corporation because they've claimed that all the liabilities are associated with, guess what, an underfunded subsidiary. Okay, corporations have perhaps always pushed the boundaries of socially accepted behavior, but just 40 years ago, that same company, Johnson & Johnson, became an important example for business school professors when it spent more than $100 million to withdraw its highly successful new product, Tylenol, from the market after seven people in the Chicago area died from taking tainted Tylenol capsules. And the company continued to invest huge amounts of money, at least on by the standards of 40 years ago, in tamper-proof packaging. Okay, this was considered a model behavior by the corporation. Today, their answer is just put the Tylenol into a subsidiary and then cause a subsidiary to declare bankruptcy and then protect the shareholders from any of the bad effects of this problem. Over the 40 years since the Tylenol incident, corporations and corporate managers have been told repeatedly and by authoritative sources like business school professors and law professors, like including probably the all four of us up on this panel, okay, that that their responsibility is to maximize share value. Moreover, that they should do whatever they can get away with, okay, as long as they can get away with it, to get cash out to their shareholders by dividends, buyouts, and stock buybacks, thereby imposing huge risks on that are predictably associated with their businesses on the other stakeholders when, surprise, the corporation does not have enough assets to make good on all of its liabilities. So I agree completely with John Macy's assertion that it is a myth that the law requires shareholders to do this, but I do not agree with him that this is a benign myth and that it serves a socially beneficial corporation. As I said initially, corporations are not people. They are legal instruments created by or authorized by government. They're supposed to have special powers. They do have special powers, okay? So as a political question, since corporations are created by government, it is appropriate to ask whether we should allow corporations to accumulate vast sums, vast resources, way beyond any other kind of institution we've ever seen in our society, and yet not demand certain standards of behavior in exchange for the privilege of being able to do so. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
All right, Professor Macy.
Coming down from New Haven, you have no idea how wonderful it is to breathe the air of freedom at a Federalist Society meeting. Thank you for having me. I do want to say that out of chaos sometimes comes order. The Federalist Society, after all, was founded at Yale Law School. So if you push lovers of liberty too far, I suppose they will organize into an effective political coalition and create a framework for coming together in civil society, as we were told this morning. It's great to be here on this panel. I want to talk a little bit about the role of corporations in society and to try and place this whole wokeness debate inside of some kind of hopefully rational framework. It's an extremely interesting and difficult topic. The basic idea is that, like so much of the rest of America, corporations have become woke, right? The idea is that CEOs and corporate directors are extremely afraid of being criticized and have taken up very left mantles of social activism. And I just want to talk a little bit about where that comes from and how someone like me who takes a decidedly libertarian bent to social issues should respond to this, and as I say, it is complicated. So the first thing that I want to talk about a little bit in response to the previous comments is to state what I think are some just ineluctable facts about the corporation, not just in the United States, but abroad as well. First of all, as a matter of being a social invention, which they are, corporations are the most powerful engine for economic growth and development in the history of mankind. We would not have had the Industrial Revolution. We would not have anything remotely approaching the levels of societal wealth that we observe and enjoy in developed countries without this social construct called the corporation. What is the genius of the American corporation? It's pretty simple. It's the only legal vehicle, the only mechanism that allows for the accumulation of the massive amounts of capital needed for an industrial enterprise without that source of capital being the government. So the corporation, in a sense, is the only thing really standing between us and socialism. In addition, as something of kind of icing on the cake with respect to the corporation is the idea that corporations can fund themselves by taking small amounts of capital from millions and millions of people and their pension funds, their 401k funds, et cetera, et cetera. And these companies, these shareholders, while I've argued, as Margaret Blair mentions, that these people are not the owners of the corporation in any way that we think about from a sort of, you know, property law perspective, the fact of the matter is that these people profit, we, the investors, profit when the corporations flourish. And in that sense, we have that attribute of ownership, of being the, what economists would call the residual claimants on the cash flows of the enterprise. So the question is, really, in a way, what is the role of the corporation in society? What are corporations supposed to do? And the default rule, the basic paradigm, although this can be altered as it should be by contract, is that corporations maximize profits within the confines or within the constraints established by law. That is what corporations do, and that is why they are created, and that is why people invest in corporations. Now, in addition, or kind of as a second point in terms of what corporations are supposed to do, is to maximize profits within the barrier, within the confines of the law. Corporations are plagued by what are known as agency costs. That is, we have hundreds and thousands and often millions and millions of shareholders, and these shareholders are unable to coalesce into an effective coalition to monitor what their directors and officers are doing or to exercise any meaningful control. So we rely on market forces to do that. So while it is true that there's no, that corporate officers and directors have massive amounts of discretion, and they're not required to maximize profits in any operational sense, I want to talk about a few characteristics of the corporation that cause corporations to be decidedly profit maximization in their orientation. These are market forces by and large, not legal forces, and they're contractual forces. First and foremost is the idea that when we're thinking about the woke corporation, right, when we're thinking about the idea that corporations should not, as the Business Roundtable, a group of CEOs in the U.S. have said, when people talk about the idea that the corporation should not maximize profits for shareholders, but rather should try to advance broad societal ends, we need to keep three institutional facts, I think, at the three or four institutional facts at the foremost of our minds. The first is that shareholders and only shareholders elect directors. So to the extent that people are talking about reframing the basic role of the corporation in society, that's an ineluctable reality that people have to contend with. A second ineluctable reality is that compensation packages, the way in which officers and directors are compensated, is overwhelmingly oriented as an empirical matter towards stock price performance and profits, right? So that is the way that the compensation scheme, that's where officers and directors' bread is buttered, if you will. In addition, there's a hierarchical and Darwinian process for getting into the C-suite, for becoming the CEO of a company, and corporate culture overwhelmingly advances people who are competent at their jobs, where competence is defined as being able to maximize profits by producing the best quality products at the lowest possible price. And finally, there's the market for corporate control, the idea that there are activist investors, there are hedge funds investors, who are overwhelmingly profit maximizers. So that when you have corporations, and there's a ton of evidence for this, who veer too far from the profit maximization paradigm, as Danone Yogurt did several years ago, active investors buy shares, replace management with people who are going to work to maximize value in the corporation. So I wanted to start with that by way of background and then quickly sort of pivot to talking with you and thinking with you a little bit about this phenomenon that Judge Sutton mentioned in his introduction about ESG investing. What is ESG investing all about, this idea of investing for environmental and social and governmental issues, and how should we think about this? Well, the first thing I want to say is, my bottom line on this is that this is much sound and fury signifying nothing. But having said that, I think it's very important to pay assiduous attention to the amount of sound and fury that there really is. In this year alone, if we count up the amount of investment in sort of woke ESG-oriented investments, it comes up to $17.1 trillion. That is a significant increase over just 2020, when there were $12 trillion. Now, these people may not, and as I'll argue in just a minute, these people may not kind of know what they're getting when they make these ESG investments, but we have to recognize, or I have to recognize anyway as a libertarian, that these are people allocating their own capital in ways that they think will make them feel better or make the world better. I want to specifically talk about, you know, what is it that people who are engaged in ESG investing think that they're accomplishing? And I don't want to be too cynical about this, but I think people are, and I'm not going to be too cynical, just cynical enough, I suppose, but you know, people think, well, we have these massive problems in this country with environmental issues, global warming and the like, that many believe pose an existential threat to the survival of the planet. And we also have the idea of perception of Tom and Mr. Professor Piketty and others have observed increasing gaps in wealth and income distribution. If one thinks about it for a second, what ESG investing does is to take the two problems that from a political theory standpoint are problems for which government intervention is required, where there are massive free rider and collective action problems associated with these kinds of investments. And they're saying, well, and this is why as a libertarian, I have a fond place in my heart for ESG investing. It is a massive libertarian turn where people are essentially saying, we can't imagine any longer, realistically, that government can solve the problems of society. And so we're turning to a much more reliable and efficacious source for solving these problems, which is the modern American public corporation. I want to mention that from a kind of interest group perspective, from an interest group perspective, there are a few issues that coalesce very, very nicely here. First of all, ESG investing is coming up as a counter that incumbent management has to activist shareholding investments. They can say, CEOs can say, and they do on a daily basis, well, my share price performance was very good. I didn't do a great job of generating profits for the shareholders in the last quarter, but I'm woke. I'm doing a good job in terms of ESG investing, and therefore you should not throw me out on the street, Mr. Activist Investor. But the fact of the matter is, while it's extremely easy to quantify corporate share price performance and to look at accounting results and see how well a company is doing in profits, there is no way to tell how a company is doing from an ESG perspective. Studies have shown that, if you look at the major institutions that rate ESG investing, there's no correlation. You look at the Carbon Disclosure Project, the Sustainable Investing Accounting Standards Board, Climate Disclosure Standards Board, several ISS. There are several of these large institutions that purport to rate ESG performance, but there's tremendous heterogeneity. Where you don't have tremendous heterogeneity when you look at Standard & Poor's or Moody's and other credit rating agencies looking at credit worthiness, but everybody can pick some vector on which they are on which they are successful. They may not be successful in doing good things for the environment, but maybe they're good in pay parity. Or maybe they have the chairman's office split from that of the CEO, so they do well in terms of the governance aspect in corporate governance. So we have a tremendous amount of cheap talk associated with ESG investors. And we have a very discreet, finite group of people who benefit from ESG investing. Modern financial economist, Luigi's colleagues at the University of Chicago, primarily among them, have done tremendous work in corporate finance on portfolio theory and the efficient capital markets hypothesis, and boiling down a ton of great work and several Nobel Prizes into a single kind of takeaway is the idea that for the average investor who does not have superior information to that which is in the market, the best form of investment is an index fund. Index fund investing, though, is no fun for Wall Street because the fees generated by index fund investing are extremely low, rapidly approaching zero. But by raising up ESG investing as a high order of priority, we can move investors from unprofitable investments in Wall Street to extremely high cost, high fee investing. So this entire ESG movement, I think, fits very well into a public choice model. It fits very well in terms of the private interest of Wall Street, the private interest of and the private interest of incumbent management. And so I'm very cynical about it. But on the other hand, and I'll end with this, we have to remember that these are people who are spending their own money, and the facts on the ground leave me confident that profit maximization will remain the paradigm as long as directors are elected by shareholders. We have a vibrant market for corporate control, and a compensation of managers is oriented towards stock price performance and profits. Thank you so much.
First of all, thank you very much for this great opportunity. I think that we live very much in an upside-down world where liberal icons like former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, wishes that a billionaire would buy out Twitter to shut up Trump before he was shut up by Jack Dorsey himself. Where fervent opponents of Citizen United actually cheer at corporation that blackmail states over their electoral laws. Where it takes a conservative like Senator Josh Hawley, paraphrasing Theodore Roosevelt, to say, I am for business, but I am for democracy first. And I am for business as an adjunct to democracy. You would expect a Democrat to say that, but in fact, Democrats seem to prefer business to democracy. This is the reason why it's important, in my view, to go back in this debate to first principle. One of the advantages of economics has a lot of disadvantages, but one of the advantages is that we have a strong theoretical framework that can help us answer this question, not based on whether we like a particular outcome, but whether an outcome is good for society overall, and whether, and this is what I want to emphasize today in particular, it preserves our freedom. So on this issue of social activism, I want to start distinguishing, and this is the most important distinction, whether we are talking about a competitive industry or a non-competitive one. So in a competitive industry, firms are price and rule takers. In a competitive industry, firms should have the right to choose the level of wokeness their customers, their employees, and their investors want. A Jewish publisher might not want to publish Nazi sympathizing books. A black-owned movie theater may not want to show Gone with the Wind. A Hindu-owned restaurant may not want to serve beef. If these decisions are value-maximizing, because made in response of customers or workers' demand for certain products, they can be made by managers who are incentivized to maximize value. If consumers are willing to pay a sufficiently large premium for sustainable fish tuna, some companies will find it profitable to sell tuna fish in a sustainable way. If workers are willing to work at lower wages for environmentally friendly companies, many companies will find it profitable to become environmental friendly. So when consumers or workers demand something, I think managers can supply it in a perfectly competitive and profit-maximizing way. Now, what happens if these decisions are not value maximizing? I'm not saying that they shouldn't be made, but they should be made by who pays for this cost, which are the shareholders. So assume that a small pharmaceutical firm has discovered a formula for a very effective day after pill. If the vast majority of its shareholders are devout Catholics and passionate pro-life advocates, they can choose not to pursue the commercialization of this drug, even if it maximizes profits. Now, the decision should not be made by a manager, should be made by the shareholders. Why? Because managers are chosen on the basis of their business acumen, not of their moral values. And so, eventually, the moral value decision should be made by who pay the ultimate cost, which are the shareholders. The beauty of this competitive world is twofold. First of all, each stakeholder pays a cost for her choice, which is related to the cost of offering this choice. Thus, the consumer pays a higher cost for the tuna, the worker receives a lower wage for the pleasure to work in an environmentally friendly company, and shareholders give some of their profits opportunity away to follow their conscience. The second, and even more important benefit, is that the competitive nature of the market ensures the freedom of choice for the people who have different belief systems. If enough people love to eat beef, some restaurant will specialize in serving beef. If abortion is legal, other firms will produce the after-day pill. Now, the situation is very different when firms have market power. If I am the only restaurant in town and I don't serve beef, no customers can eat beef. Furthermore, the nearby farmer cannot afford to raise cows because there's not enough demand for that. And so even the people who want to eat beef at home might not be able to have the beef because the beef is not supplied. Furthermore, in a monopoly situation, the patrons expressing a preference do not necessarily have to pay for the cost of their choices. If the majority of consumers is environmental friendly, they can force the monopolist tuna supplier to offer sustainable tuna without having to pay for the additional cost, since the monopolist can pay for this cost with his monopoly profits. When any product or service is offered at a zero price, it will be overconsumed. So the first consequence is, in a monopolist world, wokeism is overconsumed. More importantly, it does compress the freedom of the rest of the population. With a monopolist, the majority imposes its will on the minority, compressing its freedom. This is one of the many reasons why monopolies are bad. And by the way, for the future panel, this has nothing to do with the important point of consumer welfare standard. Monopolies are bad beyond the consumer welfare standard. So far, I've just assumed that firms are monopolies, or more generally, their market power, ignoring why they have it. More often than not, the existence of a monopoly is the direct consequence of an action, or lack of thereof, by the government. The NFL is a legally sanctioned cartel. Facebook is a monopoly generated by the lack of regulation to force interoperability among social networks. After all, we'll have a monopoly in phones if there wasn't interoperability in our cell phones, and we don't have that interoperability. So the problem is that the first concern of every monopoly is to preserve itself. The most effective way to preserve itself is to cozy up to the political power and offer a Faustian pact. I, monopolies, give you, party in power, what you want and cannot legally obtain in Congress, and you, party in power, guarantees me that my monopoly power will remain intact for the years to come. So think about the following Faustian pact. I, Facebook, give you, Democratic Party, the right to censor free speech that you cannot obtain in Congress, and you, Democratic Party, ensure that I, Facebook, can maintain my monopoly for the foreseeable future. This form of quid pro quo is the most pernicious form of corruption because it ends up hurting the majority of the citizens for the benefit of the few. Even when the quid pro quo is not so explicit, monopolist firms like to ingratiate the political power by performing actions that are liked by the party in power. So do you remember that Carrier air conditioner slowed down the move to jobs to Mexico just to please the then President Trump? Again, this is a dangerous form of profitable social activism. In these cases, attacking the social activists rather than the monopoly is not only misguided, but also counterproductive. It does exactly what the social activist CEOs want you to do. Talk about activists rather than monopoly. I will not fall in this trap, so I will end my speech by talking not about activism, but talking about monopolies and how to fight them. By far, the most powerful and dangerous are digital monopolies, in particular because they can span the world of the media. I don't have the time to describe how all the monopolies can be fought, but let me give you some indication how the monopoly by Facebook can be fought. In many countries, the electoral power grid, a natural monopoly, is separated from electricity production. In the same way, we should separate social media networking infrastructure from the editorial role. Today, the two things are done in the same company, but they can easily be separated. Now, notice that the network externality, the non-competitive part that creates the natural monopoly, is the grid component, while the editorial function would benefit from competition. And so if we can separate the two, we can have a regulated public monopoly that does simply the posting, And then you can have, on the most important part, that is how you edit the content, you can have free competition there. Now, of course, you need to break up the two things, because otherwise the one part will subsidize the other, killing the possibility for competition. Now, if you are concerned about somebody talking about breaking up a big business, I want to end with a statement written by George Stigler, Nobel Prize winner from the University of Chicago, that in 1952 said, "The obvious and economical solution is to break up the giant companies. This, I would emphasize," this is Stigler talking, "is the minimum program and is essentially a conservative program." And people say, what is conservative about that? It's because it guarantees no continuous interference in the private operation of business that is required or desired. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks very much to the Federalist Society. It is wonderful to be here in person. Now, concerns about private power and its potentially malign effects on a good government and civil society are not new. The founders of the United States of America were highly alert to, one might even say obsessed with, the possibility of corruption and what they saw as its profound dangers. In the run-up to the American Revolution, colonists had repeatedly accused King George and his ministers of usurping power by bestowing special economic privileges on actual and potential political supporters. Claims that this conduct threatened the colonists' liberties found a wide and receptive audience, due in no small measure to the low cost of printing press technologies, and helped convince Americans they needed to break away from the British Empire to form a new nation. Once independent, as economic historian John Joseph Wallace observes, Americans worried constantly about their governments and how to design their political institutions to limit the capacity of politicians to deliberately create rents by limiting entry into valuable economic activities through grants of monopoly, restrictive corporate charters. We've heard already quite a bit about monopoly from Professor Zingales, and from restrictive corporate charters from Professor Blair, and of course government regulations that favored the powerful and well connected. The influence of these principles is discernible in our Constitution. As Renee Lerner writes in her article, "Enlightenment Economics and the Framing of the U.S. Constitution," it would have been very difficult to enact directly prohibitions on the sorts of practices that we today often refer to as rent seeking. And this, I think, is a perennial problem for people like for those of us in the Federalist Society who would like to figure out ways to constrain crony capitalism and other practices that appear to be eroding a great bit of the social fabric of the United States these days. But even though these prohibitions are hard to enact directly, nevertheless, as Professor Renee Lerner has pointed out, the framers crafted numerous parts of the Constitution to further these principles indirectly, including the Commerce Clause and procedures of bicameralism and presentment for enacting bills. Also in the Constitution, of course, are explicit commitments to protections of property rights and contract rights. These provisions are, in significant part, the result of perceived excesses of tax and debtor relief laws enacted by many state legislatures in the 1770s and early 1780s. Now, our new Constitution, as you all know, succeeded brilliantly. providing a framework for the extraordinary economic growth, technological breakthroughs, and increasing political participation that characterized the United States in the late 18th and early to mid 19th centuries. As Professor Macy was discussing, we have seen an incredible explosion of economic growth made possible in significant part by our understanding of the corporate form. General corporation laws became the norm. No more need to go to the legislature to get some kind of special charter. And those, together with well-developed doctrines of commercial law and fiduciary duty, what one can do and not do with other people's money, made the United States a more open access society, one where most people, not everyone, we'll get to that, but most men had a real shot at being able to achieve great success. And their success did not hinge on government favors or the patronage of the rich or powerful. They did not have to have a patron. They didn't have to have a British lord. They did not have to have any sort of special government benefit, no special government granted monopoly. Now, the United States, of course, was not perfect. When I say the United States became a more open access society, I mean exactly that, a more open access society. We are today a more open access society than we were back then, and it is my fervent hope that the United States will continue to become, albeit not without some fits and starts, will continue to become a more open access society. Now, for all the genius of our original constitutional design, that original design proved unequal to the task of ending slavery without bloodshed. And after the Civil War came the so-called Second Founding, with the Civil Rights Act of 1866 and the Reconstruction Amendments. At the core of the Reconstruction Project was ensuring opportunities for the formerly enslaved to participate effectively in American society. And to participate effectively in American society, it was understood by all that it was essential that the formerly enslaved have the ability to enter into contracts and to own property, and that in turn, of course, enabled them to make, save, and invest money. Now, fast forward to the early 21st century. The United States is, in the early 21st century, a vastly richer and far more equal society than it was at the founding, than it was at the first founding, and of course, at the second founding. By any measure, our rule of law is an extraordinary success story, for trust in the rule of law, enforced by an impartial judiciary, is so strong that tens of millions of workers can entrust their retirement and other savings to financial firms, which in turn invest that money in, among other things, publicly traded companies. And these investors, these tens of millions of workers who have worked so hard and saved so much money, can turn their money over without fear that their savings will be siphoned off or squandered on ill-advised utopian schemes. At least that is, roughly speaking, our present system. In part, that trust is due to confidence that government, in the form of the judiciary, is going to enforce fiduciary duties. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting that fiduciary duties are perfectly enforced. Of course not. It's a difficult thing. But we do think that the courts are honest and that they take fiduciary duties seriously and that they will try to discipline bad actors when it comes to corporate managers and rogue investment counselors. And the public also has trust that the government in the form of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Reserve, and other entities who we believe have expertise and to which we have accorded power to oversee the financial industry, that these entities will serve as the protector of ordinary investors, that they will be committed, that they are committed to ensuring that the financial markets are a level playing field, or at least something close to a level playing field, and that these markets are not rigged to favor the powerful, politically well-connected sophisticates at the expense of regular mainstream investors, either through government failure to detect, prevent, and punish fraud and other bad acts. It's a very bad thing if prosecutors are asleep at the switch, or if courts are not serious about punishing unfaithful fiduciaries. And there is also the worry that government will use its vast regulatory powers. And the financial industry is extremely heavily regulated, so those regulatory powers really are quite extraordinary. And the government, the public trusts, will not use these vast regulatory powers to favor the economically and politically powerful, even though in the United States today, there are a lot of people with a lot of economic and political power. And we understand that agencies can be captured, and this worries us. This system has worked so well for so long, albeit with occasional glitches, as we saw in the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, that it's very easy to take for granted. But if history teaches anything, I believe, it is that we should not take for granted a system where so many can, with so much confidence, entrust so much money to intermediaries. There was nothing inevitable about our present world, a world in which BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, to name three of the most enthusiastic proponents of activist, which I will simply refer to as ESG investing, they hold trillions of dollars for investors who to date can trust these firms to serve as faithful fiduciaries. But the rise of activist investing, in particular the recent rapid surge of ESG, or environmental, social, and governance investing, threatens to undermine this system. Now, the system that we have now is frequently misunderstood and frequently misdescribed as one that allows, encourages, and perhaps even sometimes requires corporate managers and investment professionals to aggressively inflict or societal harms as they do their jobs, to aggressively externalize costs onto society so that their shareholders can make money. When Milton Friedman published an article in the New York Times in 1970 on corporate social responsibility, expanding and modifying arguments he had advanced in his book, Capitalism and Freedom, he was accused of, and for half a century now has continued to be accused of, producing a simple-minded greed is good narrative. But he didn't do this. Friedman's reasoning was subtle and ought to command our attention. Yes, Milton Friedman argued that the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits as much as possible, as Professor Macy was just noting. But Friedman was careful to add that business must do so while staying within the rules of the game. Understood properly, Milton Friedman's main point is that in a market-oriented democracy, there are clear, distinct divisions of labor and responsibility. Laws and regulations impose constraints on businesses. Corporate managers then act within these constraints to be faithful agents for their principals, making them maximum profits within the societal constraints. These constraints are important to respect, and we come down hard on corporate fiduciaries, corporate managers who don't respect them. They reflect the collective decisions of the voters who act through the political process to make decisions about public policy, including hard calls on how much pollution are oil companies going to be allowed to emit, where, when. By respecting these constraints, by following the rules of the game, corporate fiduciaries can be confident that they are not in conflict, or at least not in serious conflict, with society's interests. For how are we to know society's interests except by understanding that in our system, those interests are, in large measure, constructed and revealed through the political process. It is the political process that is responsible for ensuring that the externalities that Professor Blair described, which are serious problems, we should not dismiss them out of hand, but it is that process that is designed to make sure that the externalities do not get out of hand. It is that process that sets these rules of the game. When those who are trusted to serve as agents decide to pursue social goals, which are often quite amorphous, often represent particular hobby horses of the agent who's going, who's deciding to peel off a bit, they are in effect imposing a kind of tax on those whose interests they are supposed to protect. That's another kind of externality on the part of these agents. And as Milton Friedman noted, they are in a sense acting simultaneously as legislator, executive, and jurist, deciding who to tax, by how much and for what purpose, and how to spend the proceeds. All of this guided only by general exhortations to improve the environment, fight poverty, and so forth. Now, right now, the SEC, and some other organizations too, are subject to very strong pressures to adopt some form of ESG disclosure mandates. And these mandates, I believe, if instituted, are likely to put pressure on companies to adopt practices that are popular with one chunk of society, often a chunk of society that has values, has projects, has aspirations that are not necessarily those of their mainstream investors, and to adopt policies that have yet to be enacted through normal channels, generally because there isn't the political support for these policies to be put in place through the normal channels. It is Congress, the EPA, and other entities with particular expertise in the area who we have entrusted to look at the issues connected with climate change and make hard decisions, not organizations like the SEC. And there is a real danger, I believe, that the SEC and other regulators can end up being backdoor regulators for areas outside their purview. There are obviously some formidable constitutional issues here that I think will attract a great deal of attention. But even putting those aside, it's simply not a good idea. One final observation. A central feature that distinguishes poorly functioning financial markets from well-functioning ones is the association between firm valuation and political risk. When governments play favorites, political risk increases. What I see is a political climate in which the SEC, the Federal Reserve, and other government entities are faced with pressures that may lead to raised costs for firms that are out of step with the governing party's priorities. Should things go in that direction, the cost of capital for a given company could rise and fall with each change of administration. That would be a bad system, I believe, and a seismic change from the system we have now. Now, John Macy has offered persuasive comments about why this is, quote, sound and fury, signifying nothing. John is often right. John, I hope you are right here. But the speed and magnitude of the enthusiasm for ESG investing does give me pause, and I hope that at the very least we will figure out that it is important to draw a very, very, very bright line between people spending their own money to further causes that are near and dear to their hearts and people spending other people's money to do so. Thank you.
Thanks to all four of you. That was terrific. Professor Zangalis, I saw you wanted to respond or offer a thought.
Yes. Yeah. So I agree mostly with the position that Milton Friedman took in the 1970 piece, but there are two important caveats. Number one, as Julia said, Milton Friedman say firms should maximize profits staying within the rule of the game. Now, what is funny is that his next-door office mate, Joel Stigler, at the same time as he was writing the 1970 piece, was writing the 1971 piece on regulatory capture. And so we know that corporations don't stay just within the rule of the games. They make the rule of the games. And so I think that the question that we have to be careful is, does this maximize profits include that you have subvert the law to the advantage of a corporation? Of course, the answer is no. Of course, like Milton Friedman would say no. But we have to be very careful that these rules of the game are not, unfortunately, exogenous. They are endogenous. And if you push too much that argument, you endogenize them in the wrong direction. The second point is more subtle. And Milton Friedman say that corporations should do whatever they... its owners, and here is wrong, and whatever the shareholders wish, which is most of the time, make as much money as possible. So Milton Friedman recognized that sometimes owners have other objectives other than money. So the example I made is not a hypothetical. I think that there are choices that shareholders might want to make that are not profit maximizing. If I am the sole owner of a pharmaceutical company and I don't believe in abortion, I don't want to develop in a day after pill, even if that's profitable. And if I am alone, I don't want to do it. If we are three of us and all of us are Catholic, we don't want to do it. If I am a million of us and a million of us are all Catholic and we don't want to do it, we should have the right not to do it. Now, this is important because what he's saying is there is a good way to do ESG, which is to ask the shareholders what they want. And being fair with the fact that ESG costs money. Because if it doesn't cost money, is not real ESG, is simply what Friedman said, you maximize profits. If this is good in the long term, then you don't need a special dispensation to do it, is profit maximizing. If it's not profit maximizing, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. There are moral values that I'm willing to sacrifice money for. And so, however, I should be asked. And so I think that the way we wanna confront this movement is not by saying, you shouldn't do any, because eventually people will say, we're going to do some. We should say, we should actually ask the people who pay for it. And so they're not the managers, but are the ultimate shareholders.
Professor Mahoney, I want to follow up on that and maybe put the point this way. So it's one thing for the SEC or government agencies to require it. Let's put that on the side, because I get those are pretty easy to think through that problem. So it's not mandated, so you have either ESG funds or ESG leadership of a company. Who cares? These ESG funds, so they're 50, 100 basis points extra. You're losing a percent a year that you wouldn't spend on an index fund. As far as I'm concerned, that's a voluntary tax. And then over the years, let's say your return, recently they've had good returns. Maybe that's just all the money piling in. But over 10 years, you're losing money, and you either decide, I kind of like losing money because I feel so good about the values of this company, or you buy another, you find someone else, you get an index fund. Why? That seems libertarian and...
Exactly. I agree with you completely on that. So, I mean, if you wish to go and buy fair trade coffee, I say that's fantastic. If you say to me, I've been researching how hard it is to engage in effective philanthropy, this is absolutely true, and I think I would be better off purchasing items from corporations that tell me plausibly that they engage in certain kinds of labor practices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I'm willing to pay more for products, I say that's fantastic. Now, there are, of course, difficulties in monitoring those who you trust to be philanthropic intermediaries. That's not a problem, however, that's unique to ESG, right? That's a huge problem of the whole nonprofit sector. I'm a big fan of civil society and so forth. I very much enjoyed, appreciated Judge Lepar's comments about the importance of civil society and how it is a backbone of the United States. I agree with all that. But when it comes to charity, we all know that it can be very, very difficult to figure out, to find trustworthy intermediaries for one's generous projects. And to the extent that I think ESG has a future or should have a future, it is in this area of, in effect, allowing for effective charity, effective philanthropic style projects. When I say that there are some complications, there's a lot of misleading of people, I think, in terms of the good that's actually being done, and we need to think about that. But the basic idea, I'm with you completely.
So I've got a few more questions, but people that want to ask questions, feel free to come up to the mic, and I'll give you a shot. Professor Blair, so one trick of ESG investing, whether it's leadership of a company or a fund, is measuring success. So, one of the easy things to think about with profit maximizing, it's pretty easy to measure shareholder return. And, what's a social return on investment? And how do you measure that? How do you say the manager did a good job of a company or the investment stock picker did a good job picking stocks.
Yeah, this is a huge issue. I mean, I started writing about these issues about 30 years ago, and one of the first things I ran into was the difficulty of measurement. And in the late 1990s, there was a big interest in these kinds of issues among accounting firms because, if you recall, what else was going on in the late 1990s, there was a big run up in the stock prices of any firm that had a .com at the end of its name, and there were a lot of people out there who said, "Wait a minute, we've been creating value all the time, and not all of the value is measured in the conventional accounting ways. If these people can just put a .com at the end of their name and get people to invest in them, why don't we should, and they're running other kinds of businesses, we should learn how to explain to our investors where where we think the value is coming from that may not be measurable in the form of conventional assets." And there was a big interest in this, and there was a lot of accounting push, and I ran a big project at the Brookings Institution back then to look at this and see if we're, and it was one of the most discouraging projects I ever undertook, because there is no simple answer about measuring a lot of the things that we all know have value that go on inside corporations, the intangible assets where there's not a market, the human capital, the ideas, the camaraderie you built, the whatever it is, the reputational capital. These things, we can't measure them, except we can look at the total at the end of the day, and we can ask by what amount does the share price of the corporation exceed its property, plant, and equipment, and all the rest of it must be intangibles, right? That's about the best we came up with. And here we are 25 years later, and we still have made very little progress. It isn't the same world, however. So one of the things that is different now is that there's enough people out there that have been trying and putting out metrics and measuring things and posting them, that there's beginning to be some coalescence around certain ideas. So it's measuring your car. There are standards for measuring your carbon footprint. Okay, there's not just one way to do it, and the SEC and the accounting industry hasn't adopted a particular way to do it. But there's a narrowing of the choices. We are closing in on better ways to measure certain kinds of things. And that's happened because people cared about it and people have worked at it for a long time now for trying to figure these things out. The other thing that's happening, and I guess these are all tributes to civil society because these are happening outside of government, that is helping in this regard is another thing that I've written about, which is what I call third-party certification. So this is turning up in a lot of as a way to let your investors know, here's what we're doing, and in fact, there's this third party out here that certifies we in fact are doing that. Again, they're all over the map, and some of them are bogus, but there is a gradual coalescence toward some standards in these kinds of areas.
Professor Macy, I want to give you one shot at either responding to some of these comments or to this question. There are a lot of libertarians here. Why shouldn't libertarians say, we love this? Government gets in the way. Put ESG funds to the side. We're talking ESG leadership of corporations. You can have a Hobby Lobby here. You can have a climate-sensitive company there. What's not to like about this? Let these companies run the world.
I'm going to be very succinct because I want to hear questions. But the basic answer is, I think, was supplied by Luigi, which is it's fine if I'm the CEO of a company and I want to devote my life to volunteering for Greenpeace. It's quite another thing to do it with other people's money. And that's my concern.
Yeah. All right, first question. Say where you're from and name, and sure. If you want to direct it to somebody, that would be great.
Hi, I'm the Daniel Orter from the Pacific Legal Foundation. Question, I think this is to anyone, is if anyone would like to comment on the recent trend from both regulators like the state of California and also organizations like the NASDAQ to be imposing social policies on corporations, such as diversity quotas, requiring a certain number of women or racial minorities or LGBT individuals to be on corporate boards. And those kind of, the shift towards those policies and what that says about social activism and corporate policy.
Professor Mahoney, do you want to try that one? Or Professor Blair?
I didn't understand the question. Maybe my hearing's bad, but there's a lot of noise back there.
I'm sorry. So I was asking about the trend of states and also organizations like the NASDAQ to impose policies on corporate boards and corporations, such as the requirement from the state of California and the NASDAQ that corporations have a certain number of women or minorities on their corporate boards, and what implications those, the new direction towards states or government entities imposing those kinds of policies on corporations, what that has to say for the tier.
I'm torn about whether the law should require this. I guess I don't really think it's an appropriate role of government to say this, but increasingly, investors want it, okay? And I think inside corporations, the conversation that's being had is around. I think inside corporations, they really are asking questions like, wait a minute, you know, we have not worried about these things in the past because it was it didn't seem like it made much difference, but we're not going to be a profitable company in the long run if society falls apart. So we do need to think about whether there are things that we should be doing in order to, in general, improve the overall fairness and the overall functioning of society at large. So, you know, is putting minorities and women on boards helps that? I think it's likely to give corporations new perspectives on things that can be helpful to them. So I'm not opposed to them doing that, certainly. I'm not sure I think it should be mandated by law.
Okay, over here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, speak up if you could.
Yeah, okay. I'm Robert Barker from Atlanta. I've represented public companies. Right now I represent a lot of private companies and private investors. And so I followed the debate for a long time from various sources. And I think, you know, there's all sorts of people putting mandates in place. Norway requires 40% of the boards to be comprised of women, I think. And those have been around for a long time. And I was intrigued by the idea of rules of the game that Professor Mahoney put forward and Professor Zingales picked up on. So I would kind of like to ask Professors Blair and Mahoney this question, because it seems to me that there are two different kinds of rules of the game. There are the larger rules of the game, like tax policy and how much you can take out, and there's some other things. And then there's some smaller rules of the game, which, according to the Delaware courts post-Revlon, for example, would not necessarily say that the rules should be imposed as long as they don't accept shareholder value. So they leave a great deal of discretion to the managers under the business judgment rule. So I'm sort of looking back in history, and you look at it, and you know, in Genesis, I guess the book of Genesis is when you first look at this, where Joseph tells Pharaoh, well, you can let the owners, the entrepreneurs, keep 80% of their wealth as long as you only take 20% during the years of fat. Okay, that's fine. Then you roll forward to modern times where Professor Blair was calling this consensus develops. So in the 30s, there was a consensus in Germany.
Let's roll forward to the present and the question.
I'm going very quickly. This will be my last historical example. I move from Genesis to the 30s. But in the 30s, you have a situation where you say, in Germany, there's a consensus. We shouldn't have Jews on the board. So that becomes the law. There's a consensus that corporations make too much money. And so Hitler says, okay, well, if it's above 6.5%, you have to use all your profits to buy German war bonds. So what are the rules of the game, and how do you distinguish between these two rules? And how do you develop a consensus that is good for all times, not just for Genesis or the 30s?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good follow-up. So you got business judgment rule, which gives a lot of flexibility to the board and management, and then you have mandates, which narrow that. So maybe Professor Mahoney, and let's try to keep the answers fairly short and the questions short as well, so everyone gets a shot. Professor Mahoney one. Go ahead.
I will keep the answer very short. The answer is yes, we have rules of the game, and an enormous amount of what we do at the Federalist Society concerns making sure that those rules of the game are in accordance with our Constitution, its text, and its principles.
Here we go.
Yes, I'm Sam Wright from Marlin, Texas. For Professor Macy, you seem to express a reluctant admiration for ESG because people are playing with their own money. But is it not true that a lot of the clout for ESG comes from state and local government pension funds that are massively overpromised and underfunded, and when they focus on something other than maximizing return on investment, they make their own fiduciary problems that much worse?
I couldn't agree with you more, and I should have drawn a distinction between a situation where, you know, John Smith is putting his money in his own 401k and he can do whatever he wants with it, versus public pension funds, which are using other people's money. I'm right 100% in agreement with you. Great point.
Can I?
Okay. Oh, go ahead, Professor Blair.
I just want to address that question. This was 20 years ago, it would have been an accurate description that all of the pressures for ESG and that sort of, they didn't use the term that back then, but all the pressures or a substantial portion of them were coming from public pension funds, the pension funds of teachers and civil servants and that sort of thing. That's not true anymore. That's not what's going on. I mean, you don't get up to, what is it, $17 trillion worth of assets being invested if you're just looking at, so it's coming from a very, very broad basis. And I think it goes to the question of, you know, people always say, well, you know, Milton Friedman didn't really say they should do everything. He said they should do everything within the rules of the game. Well, where do the rules of the game come from? Well, there are the written rules, the law, and the court decisions, okay. But there's also norms. And Professor Macy agrees that maximizing shareholder value is a norm. It's not a legal requirement, okay? So that the norms are changing. And I personally think that that's probably a good thing.
Over here.
Good morning. Michelle Roberts of BlackRock. Larry Fink recently wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in these last weeks where he argued that rich countries must put more taxpayer dollars to work driving the net zero transition abroad, and that $1 trillion a year in public and private investment is required to drive down emissions. I'm wondering if any of the panelists read the op-ed and how they would analyze it from the perspective of rule of law, separation of powers, and first principles. Thank you.
Anyone want to take a shot at this, Professor Tsongalis?
Yeah, I think that the ultimate decision should be in the hands of the investor in BlackRock and the one who put the money in the funds. I think that the fact that Larry Fink advocates for himself the right to decide overall the pensioner, he's managing, what, $8 trillion in asset. He has a power that is disproportionate. So that's the reason why I strongly believe we need to create systems so that people can transfer their preferences and direct the votes of all this money in the direction they want, not in the direction Larry Fink wants. I think that Larry Fink is too powerful for today's society.
Professor Macy, did you want to respond to that?
I think we'll should probably go to
okay, next one. Great.
Thank you. Anthony Bruno, I'm from California. I'm an in-house counsel at Apollo Global Management. Real quick question. I kind of want to drill down the idea of shareholder ratification for some of these investments, fiduciary duties. What are the proposed remedies to situations where companies might be going in a direction that is not maximizing shareholder value? Are you suggesting shareholder derivative suits? How does that square with business judgment rule? What are some concrete remedies people who may dissent can avail themselves to?
Well, I think pass-through voting. Oh, sorry. I think pass-through voting is a very good idea. I think ex-ante approval is probably superior to ex-post ratification.
Yes, I agree. I think we should look very carefully at more pass-through voting.
Over here.
Hi, Randall Johnson, various jobs. Is it possible to contrast the rules of the road with regard to corporations and ESG funding as distinguished from corporations and then the rules of the road applicable to fiduciaries running the 401k plans? It strikes me, and of course it's a little different with multi-employer plans where the trustees are both union and employer. But a repeated argument, to put it simply, is, for example, should pension plans, 401k plans, be invested in union housing to create jobs for union members, and residually there's a payoff down the road, perhaps. That was really before the ESG investing, but it strikes me that fiduciaries ought to be under a tighter obligations with investing 401k plans and corporations in general. But I don't know if there's a separate rules of the road there or not. And that might be a question for you, Julia.
It's a great question. I mean, to say that someone is a fiduciary, of course, only begins the inquiry. We need to know much more. Trustees of trusts are held, of course, to stricter duties, stricter standards in a way than our corporate fiduciaries. When it comes to retirement money, I would endorse a very, very strong fiduciary standard, full stop, regardless of whether it is a public pension fund, private 401k, or whatever. I think it is just way too easy for there to be schemes that sound good, but which are actually either complete wastes of money, wishful thinking, or worse yet, feathering the nests of the politically well-connected.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Brian Bishop from the Stephen Hopkins Center in Rhode Island, and I just wanted to briefly ask, we've been talking a bit about the kind of concealed carry version of ESG investing, but at least with people using their money to forward ideas, even ideas about the market, I think of the GameStop as the open carry kind of version, where people are expressing a concern about what's happening in the market, and then we came to the conundrum of, should they be regulated not to be able to do that for their own protection, that it created more problems of regulation, in a sense, when people did take that individual prerogative.
Professor Zagalli, I'm not sure you followed the GameStop reference, but you might be a good person to talk about this, because you do seem to believe in government regulation when it comes to antitrust law. And maybe there is...
Yeah, I do know the GameStop story. I think that I don't see... If people are consulting adults and they're not gambling with their pension money, because if they're gambling with their pension money, eventually all of us are on the hook. But if they are consulting adults and gambling with their money, I think that you should let them gamble. And I think that the risk intervening in a situation like this is to favor somebody else. So there were a lot of hedge funds that were asking for the first time for regulation because they lost money. And you don't want to cave into those demands. Those are terrible.
Okay, next.
I'm Brad Russell. I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. Professor Macy, if you like breathing free air, you should come down to Florida. but I'd like to hear the panelists. I'd like to hear the panelists' thoughts on the proliferation of ESG practice groups at all of the leading law firms. It seems to me that that Professor Macy's three fundamental facts of the corporation would ordinarily prevent too much harm from this new ESG movement. But if all of the law firms are recommending that corporations follow ESG, it seems like that might be a way of imposing social pressure that is not law, but essentially has the effect of law.
Yeah, no, that's a fascinating point. I want to be clear that, I guess the only issue I have with the way you frame the question, it's a great question, is the extent to which law firms are faithful agents of their clients, right? I mean, the ESG groups at law firms are not themselves philanthropies or eleemosynary arms of the law firm. They're billing their clients for providing this advice. So law firms have a huge interest in the kind of SEC-mandated ESG disclosure that Professor Mahoney was talking about, because it provides a demand for the services of law firms and the creation of ESG practice groups in order to allow their clients to comply with these rules. And so, you know, I think that law firms' push for ESG is really leaving their clients' interest at the door when they go into lobby, frankly.
Yes, thanks for raising that. If I had had more time, I would have said a few words about this development of the law firm practices, the ESG practices, and how that's part of a greater network of social pressure.
If we think about these things as changing norms, and I think we do need to think about them that way, the share value maximization norm emerged out of the takeover activity of the 1980s and late 70s, 80s, and it came out of finance, and it began to infiltrate into, you know, broad-based thinking that this is what should be done. Well, what kind of effect did that have? In the 1980s, you may remember, interest rates were extraordinarily high. We had a period of time in which, there was a period of time in which the interest rates on Treasury securities was as high as 12 and 14%. And so if you have companies introducing finance concepts into the way they're running their companies, and they're starting to do present value calculations, okay, and the underlying interest rate is 10%, 11%, 12%, their internal hurdle rate that they have to meet may be 15, 16, 18%. You can't think about the long term if you've got a discount rate of 20% or 15%. You cannot think about the long term. You have to disinvest now. Okay, so we had a whole set of practices that gradually worked their way into the way corporations operate, the way their managers are, the way B-schools taught things. And you had this tension because the managers of the corporations in the 1980s were saying, don't pay attention to those Wall Street guys. They just have a very short-term mentality. Well, yeah, your mentality is really short-term in you're facing an environment of 15 and 20% discount rates. So now what's going on? Discount rates practically zero. Okay, we all better be thinking long term with a discount rate as low as they are in this time. So it's become socially acceptable again to think long term and to pay attention to social factors and other kinds of issues that will affect the business and affect the ability of the whole planet to survive over the next few centuries. So thank you.
All right, this is perfect. Our last questioner will be the former Secretary of Labor, who I think has thought about this a little bit.
Yeah, thanks. Gene Scalia. So this has been a great panel. I just want to touch on two things that I think are extremely important as we talk about this area. One is the different rules applicable to pension plans, which John touched on, Professor Mahoney. There is a different legal standard there, and not just for defined benefit plans, for 401ks too. You know, when I was at the Labor Department, we did a rule on that. There's now been a proposal to withdraw that. People interested in this area should regard that as one area where the standards governing ESG investing are particularly high. The second thing I want to say is that, you know, a lot of the discussion today has been in the context of, you know, people free to do what they'd like, you know, with their money, or corporations responsibly doing so. But there's a very important SEC rulemaking that I think we'll see early next year, which will force ESG disclosures as to certain things that the SEC thinks should be promoted: climate change and the social values that some people hold. And so that really radically changes the context in which a lot of this discussion's occurred, where suddenly companies are forced to disclose the things that they're doing in certain areas. If they're doing good things or say they're doing good things, good for them, unless the SEC decides they're not doing good enough things and there's an enforcement action. If they're falling short and say, hey, we're kind of falling short, then they're subject to public opprobrium. So I think that's a very important rulemaking coming down the road that alters some of the terrain we've been talking about, where it's, you know, free people, free markets, free decisions.
Yes, you became our fifth panelist. Anyone want to respond to our fifth panelist who has several terrific observations?
I agree, Gene. You're absolutely
yes,
right.
I agree. No.
Well, a lot of agreement with an excellent way to end. So it's 11:30, so
ahead,
if you
right?
have a breakout session with a lunch, find it. Otherwise, there'll be lunch out there. And thank you so much to our four panelists.